We're starting out somewhat behind where we were supposed to be at this hour because we should have been ready to start with verse 5. But we spent a good deal of time this morning on not forgetting the Lord and His teaching. And we have had in verse 1 through 4, which is the introduction, we've had the negative commandment, do not forget my teaching, the positive commandment, keep my commandments, and then the triple promise that involves length of days, quality of life, and serenity of life. And now we're ready with the next verse to begin the second set of negative and positive commands. And first of all, we have the first negative. And the first negative says in verse 3, do not let kindness and truth leave you. Now this has two very important words in it, and the first one is do not let kindness depart from you. Kindness probably is the most important word in the Old Testament. It is so important that we have mentioned it many, many times. It is the word chesed. And we will put it down here so we can have some idea of it. H-E-S-E-D, and I put a little dot under the H so that if you're a purist and you want to be sure and not say chesed, but you want to say chesed, then you'll have the Hebrew somewhat correctly pronounced. The idea of this word, and fix it in your mentality because it's an attribute of God. It's the way, this word is what grace is to the New Testament. Suppose we did not have the word grace in the New Testament. Would something be missing in the church age? Obviously so. Paul begins his letters, grace to you and peace. And what grace is to the New Testament, chesed is to the Old Testament. And it involves this, and simply put in your memory what is involved with chesed. It is faithfulness to a responsibility based on a relationship. It is faithfulness to a responsibility based on a relationship. That's chesed in the Old Testament, translated often loving kindness, but I'm certain that our English word kindness does not come across in that way. It's a word that means you are faithful to a duty or a responsibility based on a relationship. For example, God has chosen Israel, and it says He always acts toward Israel in chesed. And it simply means that He has a relationship to them. They are His chosen people. And out of that relationship, He is always, always, always faithful to it. Now let me show you that in two places. First of all, Genesis chapter 20. Genesis 20. And I want you to see that there's a relationship and a responsibility. That ought to be easy to remember. Relationship and responsibility. And the first one we're looking at, the relationship, is husband and wife. And coming out of the husband-wife relationship is a responsibility. In chapter 20 and verse 13, Abraham is going to address Sarah, his wife, and say, on the basis of our relationship, I'm going to give you a responsibility or a duty. Verse 13 says, it came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, that is my wife, this is the chesed which you will show to me. Everywhere you go, say of me, he is my brother. And what did Sarah had? She had a responsibility based on her relationship to her husband. So here we've got a relationship of husband and wife and a responsibility coming out of it. Same book, chapter 47. Whenever you see the word kindness or chesed, ask what's the relationship and what's the responsibility coming out of it. The two R's are always there. Chapter 47 and verse 29. First of all, ask ourselves, what is the relationship? And then we'll ask, what is the responsibility? First of all, what is the relationship of these two people? Verse 29, when the time came for Israel drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, relationship, father, son. Now responsibility. Please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in chesed. And what's he saying? I have a responsibility for you in the light of our relationship. All right, taking that back now to Proverbs. And what is he saying? Negatively, do not let kindness leave you. What's he saying? If you are a husband, make it a priority that your relationship to your wife is faithfully carried out. Do your duty on the basis of that relationship. This word is also used of God's attitude toward us. God is always faithful to us because of our relationship to Him as His children. The second word that is important is truth. By the way, what kind of society would we live in if everybody carried out faithfully the responsibility of their relationships? What would happen at the place you work if every employer had hesed and faithfully carried out the responsibility of his relationship to the company? What if every supervisor and every boss carried out faithfully his responsibility to his employees? What if everybody in Congress carried out faithfully his responsibility of the position that he held? What if every wife carried out faithfully the responsibility to her husband, and every husband faithfully carried out his responsibility to his wife? What if every child faithfully carried... Every child had hesed in the parent-child relationship, perfectly carried out the responsibility given. Can you see the importance of this? And he says, bind this in your heart. This is an important thing. Faithfulness to whatever the responsibility is. All right? The second thing is the word truth. And the word truth is very simple. In Hebrew, it refers to that which is reliable. Very much like in English, truth is that which is reliable. And therefore, he's simply saying, get into your heart absolutes, that which is reliable, and be faithful to your responsibility. Now, he moves from that then to our positive command. Don't let these things go by. Do not let kindness, verse 3, and truth leave you. But here's what you're to do. Bind them on your neck, write them on your heart. And the bind them on your neck and write on the heart have two aspects. Binding on the neck is make it public. Make it public. And in your heart is make it inner. In your heart, writing in your heart is to have it on the inside, and the binding on your neck is to have it on the outside in terms of expression. Now, throughout Proverbs, we're going to find numerous times the fact that what you bind around your neck is an expression for public. Let me show you three places. Chapter 1 and verse 9. We might as well begin to learn the idea. Chapter 1 and verse 8 says, hear, my son, your father's instruction. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath unto your head. And what's the idea? If you hold what you've been taught in your home, it is going to be like a beautiful necklace around your neck. Chapter 6 and verse 21. Since this is an idiom we do not have really in English, we want to grasp what it means. To put something around your neck is to make a public display of it. Chapter 6 and verse 21. Again, talking about the teaching of your home, bind them continually on your heart, tie them around your neck. Have them on the inside, have them on the outside. Chapter 7 and verse 3, he talks about his commandments and says, bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. Public expression and private expression. All right, that is accompanied now with a second promise, a negative and a positive command, and now we have our second promise. And the second promise is in verse 4, which says, so you will find favor and good repute in the sight of God and men. The only thing we'd modify with this is the word good repute carries the flavor of success. So you will find favor and success in the sight of God and in the sight of man. Now with that, with the word God and man, we have the key to the rest of the chapter. And the first thing we now come to is, after the introduction, we now come to favor and success in the sight of God. So let's simply label our second part, from which our passage was read this morning, is success in the sight of God. How to have it. And we will have three pivotal things. Success in the sight of God, Proverbs 3, verses 5 through 12. And we'll call these things three absolute basic requirements if we're to have success with God. And before we write it, let's read it. First of all, for success with God, we must have absolute trust in Him. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 through 8. Second, if we are to have success with Him, we must honor God with material possessions, verses 9 and 10. And third, if we're to have success with God, we must submit to His training program, verses 11 and 12. So number one, first requirement is we must trust the Lord completely. That is pivotal. We must trust the Lord completely if we're to have success with God. He's now beginning to tell us how we can have success with God, and it's in verses 5, 6, 7, and 8. The first requirement, we must trust the Lord completely. And under that, let's put down what are some of the qualities of trust. What are some of the elements that make up trust? Chapter 3, verse 5. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. The first quality of trust is it must be entire. It must be entire. 5a. And that is expressed in the little word, with all your heart. The word trust is an interesting word in the Old Testament. The Hebrew word batek, translated trust, is a word that means to feel secure and unconcerned. It's used many times in a context that you are so secure that people will look at you and say, aren't you concerned? And that is very much the flavor of the word. And so the idea is trust and be unconcerned. It means we are not bothered by anything because of the object of our trust. The word also probably ties in with the Arabic root that meant to lie extended or prostrate on the ground. It was used of a wrestling term. And so if you can picture, maybe you occasionally do this, sometimes at the end of the day, one of the most relaxing things to do is not lie down on the couch or on the bed, but where? Where you feel the almost total relaxation is to get on the solid floor. And there you relax. And if you want to get the flavor of this word, think then in your own mind of here is the Lord, which is your front room floor, and you are just all spread out. You are completely relaxed in the Lord. And that is emphasizing the entirety of the trust. And then emphasizing that it is an entire. The second thing, not only must trust be entire, it also must be exclusive. It cannot be divided. Must be entire. It must be exclusive. And that is in 5b. And I think you can see that very quickly when the verse says, trust in the Lord with all of your heart and do not lean to your own understanding. The idea is we are to have confidence in Him and in Him alone. The word, by the way, in verse 5 for understanding is the word we've had previously, bina, that means ability to distinguish. And so it's simply saying, do not trust on your own ability to distinguish, your own ability to evaluate, your own ability to discriminate. All right, next, it must be entire, it must be exclusive. And number 3, it must be consistent. And that's in verse 6. And notice the 6th verse reads, in all your ways acknowledge Him. And what is that saying? This is not a come and go trust. This is a trust that touches everything, and it is an involvement of in all your ways. Remember the word ways means your conduct, your lifestyle. In all aspects of your lifestyle, acknowledge Him. Actually, the word acknowledge means to know. In all your ways, know Him. And the idea of knowing Him has to do with recognize His presence. I'll put some keywords down here. Recognize His presence, fellowship with Him in everything you do, and communicate with Him. All those ideas are involved in that little word, acknowledge or make Him known. So notice we got a very full section of saying, do you want to have success vertically? Do you want to succeed with God? Well, element number one is going to be absolute trust in the Lord. And it must be entire because it's with all your heart. It must be exclusive because you do not lean to your own discrimination. And it must be consistent because in all of your lifestyle, you acknowledge Him and recognize and fellowship and communicate with Him. So we've got our first concept then that is extremely, extremely important. Now, if we will do that, then there is a reward. And let's put this down as the spiritual reward of trust. The spiritual reward of this trust. And again, may I point out what a big order this is? No half-hearted confidence. No half-hearted resting on Him. No resting on Him and a little bit of our own mixed in. It must be exclusive. And no recognizing Him here and here, but not over here, in all of our ways. Entire, exclusive, consistent trust is what is demanded if we're to have what? If we're interested with success in the sight of God. Now that carries with it, notice, a spiritual reward. And the spiritual reward is in 6b. Notice this trust is perfect in degree with all of our heart and is perfect in extent in all of our ways. All right? Latter part of verse 6 says, and He will make your paths straight. The idea of ways or paths is the idea of your course of life. He will make your course of life or your paths straight. And what is the idea of making your course of life straight? Well, a crooked path is always longer, isn't it? If you visit Israel and you decide you were for some reason going to take a float trip down the Jordan, you could go many, many, many miles. As I recall, it's something like almost 300. Figure may be wrong, but almost 300. If you go by land from the beginning of the Jordan down where it empties into the Dead Sea, you go 60 miles. And the point is, you don't want a boat down it because it's for other reasons too, but you don't want a boat down it because what do you want to go? You want to go 300 miles? You want to go 60. And the emphasis is a crooked path is the long path. And if you would take the crooked path and make it hilly, then a hilly path is always exhausting. And isn't that the way most people choose to live life? Instead of being directed by the Lord in life, how many jaunts in the wilderness have we taken, and we've come out of the brush full of stickers and poison ivy and everything else for one simple reason? We just couldn't take the straight path. We just couldn't take the path of obedience. Or maybe you're panting right now because instead of taking the straight way, you choose to go over the top of all the hills in life. And you choose to puff and to pant and go in all of the directions that God has said, don't go that way. And consequently, you're panning through all of these things. And the promise here is obviously the straight path is ideal. It's the one of God's choosing. Now, typical of the book of Proverbs and of the Old Testament is teaching by repetition. And that's verse 7. And notice verse 7 essentially repeats what we've already had. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Have respect for the authority of the Lord and turn from evil. And then we have then in verse 8, we have the physical reward. Had the spiritual reward, and now we have the physical reward of trust. And you can say for sure that the way we think in our mind pays back in our bodies. And notice the physical trust is found in verse 8. It will be healing to your body and refreshment to your bones. Now that is simply introducing the fact that there is such a thing as what we call often psychosomatic. Sometimes called psychosomatic illness, often phrased that way. And the word psychosomatic is simply saying, let's look at the relationship of our mind to our body. It's all psychosomatic really at its heart means. The relationship of the mind to the body. And may I ask you, does Proverbs chapter 3 say there is such a thing? He says, trust in the Lord completely and entirely and totally. That's in your mind. And what will the result be? Healing to your body and refreshment to your bones. Is there a relationship here between body and the mind of man? Now let's take that and develop it a little bit further by looking at three proverbs that are going to very definitely say what goes on in your head shows up in your body. It's the idea of our blood pressure can be related to our mental attitude. Proverbs 17 and verse 22. Is there a relationship taught in the Word of God between the mind and the body? Chapter 17 and verse 22 will very clearly relate the mental attitude to the body. It says, a joyful heart is good medicine. Medicine for what? Medicine for the body. And notice, a happy, joyful mental attitude is good medicine, but, on the contrast, a broken spirit. And I think we can establish, we'll work a little bit with broken spirit in Proverbs later, but I think we can establish that a broken spirit is what we call depression. But depression, mental depression, dries up the bones. And what is he saying? There is a link between the mind and the body. A joyful spirit is like medicine for the body. And on the other hand, a depressed attitude dries up the bones. Why does he relate depression to the bones, to the body? Because there's such a thing as a psychosomatic relationship, and Proverbs recognizes it. Chapter 12, verse 25. It's another passage giving us much the same. 12:25. Verse 25 says, anxiety in the heart or the mind of man weighs it down. Now, the "it," I take it, should be taken back to verse 24, where it says, the hand of the diligent will rule. And in verse 25, anxiety in the heart of man weighs it, that is the hand, down. Let me ask a question. I think you can all answer it without any problem. Does anxiety and worry cause a person to lose their animation? Think back to the last time you were depressed and worried. And what do? You slump, don't you? How about your arms? Are you up here and animated? Don't you get a literal heavy feeling in your arms when you're depressed? And that's what Proverbs is observing, that anxiety in the mind makes the hands hang down. You lose your animation and vitality. Psychosomatic relationship of the mind to the body. Chapter 15, verse 13. Notice here we have the relationship of our mental attitude to our face. It says, a joyful heart, that's your mental attitude, makes a cheerful face. In other words, he's saying, I can look at the face and I can tell something about the mind. And from the mind, it's going to affect the face. But when the heart is sad, then you have depression or the spirit is broken. Proverbs 18, verse 14. And in Proverbs 18:14 we read, the spirit of a man can endure his sickness, but a broken spirit who can bear? Now, what is the idea involved here? I take it he's talking about, in the first part, he says, short of outward resources, life may be hard, but it's endurable. You see that? The spirit of man can endure sickness. Simply saying, if you've got the inner spirit, you can endure the pressures of life. So he'd be saying that if you don't have outward resources, life is difficult, but it is certainly bearable. In the latter part, it says, but a broken spirit, who can bear? In other words, if you don't have the inner spirit, you don't have the inner attitude, then what about life? It's unbearable. So what's he saying? In the first part, life can be difficult, but you got the right spirit, you can handle it. And in the latter part of the 12th verse, if you don't have the inner thing, then short of that, who can bear life? And the idea is collapse under it. So all of this is talking about the concept of the relationship of mind to the body. All right, let's go back to Proverbs 3 now. and I take it in verse 8, it will be healing to your body, the mental attitude of trust, physical reward, and in the idea of refreshment to your bones, I would call that the emotional reward. There's spiritual, there's physical, there's emotional reward. Very often in the expression found in the latter part of verse 8, refreshment to your bones, the word refreshment is drink, and bones often referring to your inner being. So the idea there of refreshment emotionally. All right, that then gives us the first requirement of success in God is trust in Him completely, and it has some very beautiful rewards with it. All right, the second requirement of success with the Lord is honor Him with your possessions. Honor God with your possessions or with your material wealth. And that is found in verses 9 and 10. These are pivotal things. We must trust the Lord completely. And now second, we must honor God with our material possessions. First of all, in verse 9, the requirement. Notice how we move from verse 5, trust the Lord, to a new command which says, honor the Lord. And it is honor the Lord with your wealth and from the first of all of your produce. And so notice the emphasis is that God has the priority as far as wealth and produce is concerned. And then notice with that is a blessing. So your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. So the emphasis here is God blesses only that which is given. God blesses only that which we give. And I'm not saying now that a savings account is unwise. I am saying this. God does not bless a savings account. I know that's completely contrary to human thing. God does not bless a savings account. God only blesses that which is invested. For the New Testament concept, very quickly, 2 Corinthians 9. Now, this does not mean be foolish with your money. It does not mean don't invest your money. And it doesn't mean be unwise about saving it. But there is a principle that is important. And the important principle is that which is sown is that which God blesses. 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 is the key passage in the New Testament on the subject of giving. And in verse 6 he has said, now this I say, and this is strictly a financial context or a material giving context. Now I say, he who sows sparingly shall reap sparingly. What's he saying? I bless that which is sown, not that which is kept. He who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully shall reap bountifully. God blesses seed sown. Then in verse 10, he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for saving. Please note that. He will multiply your seed for saving. No, he will multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. Same principle in the New Testament. So second pivotal concept, we must honor God with our material wealth. Back to Proverbs. And that begins in verse 11. My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord. The third requirement is we must submit to the Lord's discipline or the Lord's training program if we're to have success with Him. He's got a training program and we must submit to it, and that is found in verses 11 and 12. For memory's sake, maybe I know some people feel that the Bible is sacred in the sense you shouldn't mark it, but for the purpose of remembering these things, I've just put down my margin, bracketed off 5 through 8, trust, 9 and 10, honor, 11 and 12, submit. Those are our key ideas, and we're now looking at we must submit to the Lord's discipline. Now really, verse 11 comes in to forestall a question. If you've ever taught, you may be going through a lesson, and if you get to a certain point, you anticipate what the questions are going to be. Now, what could the anticipated question, maybe it's already come up in your mind. Has it? couldn't it be something like this so far down through verse 10? Couldn't you say, look, you have just said that if I trust the Lord and am faithful to Him, I'm going to prosper. And hey, my barns ain't full. How do you explain that? If trusting the Lord brings all of this prosperity, how come so many men who are trusting the Lord suffer so much adversity? And if you haven't had that question so far, you should, because boy, this has looked pretty simple. Trust the Lord, and if you trust the Lord, you're going to have inner tranquility and honor Him with your possessions. You say, I've done that, and your barns are going to be full, and you say, how then do you explain suffering? Because I'm having some suffering, and the way He's going to do it is to say that God prospers you, but to say that God prospers you, don't forget, God requires lots and lots and lots of push-ups in His program. And basically, we're anticipating now a question, and He's going to answer it in verses 11 and 12. You see, training programs, what do training programs imply? They imply two things, don't they? They imply success, but what else is implied in a training program? Pain, isn't it? If you're gonna say, look, I want to run the mile in 4:10. If you're of a reasonable physical condition and a reasonable age, can you achieve that goal? Can you get the success and the glory of saying 4:10, I did it? Can you get there? Yes. You can promise that you can get to that point, but how are you going to get there? Where there is no pain, what's the rest of it? There is no gain. And this is what he's going to be saying here is, yes, you can get to tremendous spiritual prosperity. You can get there. But don't think that there isn't a training program. And verse 11 is going to begin to talk about the training program. Now, these two verses, are these two verses important for the church age? Let's read them. My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord, or loathe his reproof. He, for whom the Lord loves, he reproves, even as a father the son in whom he delights. Are these verses valid for the church age? Keep your finger here and go to Hebrews 12. They are so valid that in the key passage, probably in the New Testament, on suffering and training and discipline as God's children, which is Hebrews 12, notice how relevant Proverbs is. Some of the believers addressed in the book of Hebrews had forgotten Proverbs 3. Now, don't answer this or even indicate, because I don't want it to be embarrassing. But when you came in this morning, have you always remembered Proverbs 3? Or do you have to kind of blush and say, well, I really hadn't read it till this morning? Well, notice how responsible New Testament believers are for knowing the Old Testament. And here the book of Proverbs, because in chapter 12, verse 5, the author says, and you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons, quote, Proverbs 3, 11 and 12. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by Him. For those whom the Lord loves, He disciplines, and He scourges every son whom He receives. And he says, New Testament believer, you forgot Hebrews, you forgot Proverbs, chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. So notice how relevant this is for us in the church age. All right, now let's go back to Proverbs 3. And let's put down, what is the natural reaction to discipline? What is the natural reaction to discipline? When your parents discipline you, or what is the normal reaction of a child to discipline? Mom and Dad, I can't thank you more for what you just did. I have been grounded, and I am deeply grateful for that fact. All right, what is the natural, first of all, the natural reaction to discipline, first of all, of the will? The natural reaction of the will is to reject it. I don't want it. Leave me alone. And notice verse 3, verse 11, he's warning us, my son, don't what? Reject. And rejection is not the emotional reaction. Rejection is the volitional reaction, is it not? So do not reject. He's pointing to the rejection of it. Now, if we reject God's discipline, how about Proverbs 3:5? What have we done to it? Proverbs 3:5 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. And if we reject His discipline, what have we done to Proverbs 3:5? We've just negated it. So if we won't go with the training program, forget Proverbs 3:5. We've already negated it. So rejection of the discipline will be rejection of Proverbs 3:5. And then notice in the next expression in verse 11 is don't loathe His reproof. The natural reaction of the emotions to suffering is what? Resentment. Now, very frankly, if I were told tomorrow that I had some very, very, very serious disease, my will would react to that. I don't want it. My first initial reaction would probably be, I reject even the idea. I don't believe it. And my emotions would resent it. The reason I would resent it is, Lord, look, I study hard Your Word. I teach. I try to be faithful in doing it. I don't have this coming. And don't look so pious. So would you. This is the normal human reaction, is we reject with our will and we resent with our emotions. And notice the warning in verse 11 is don't do that. Get that out of your life. Do not reject the discipline of the training program of the Lord, and don't loathe His. In other words, adjust your volition to His program, assent, I will buy into your program, I will do your push-ups in order to get to the good goal, and I will not allow myself in my mind to resent the discipline that the Lord gives to us as His children. Those are normal reactions. So notice we have the privilege in prosperity. We can honor the Lord by doing what? By giving our substance. In adversity, we can honor the Lord how? By submitting to His program. Now, why is it, and what good reason do we have for submission? So let's put now reasons for, or reasons why we should submit to His program of discipline. Reasons for submission. And the reasons for submission are found in verse 12. And they are two. We should submit to God's discipline and training because of His character. And number two, because of His position. Verse 12, because of His character and because of His position. First of all, because of His character. For, verse 12 is saying, this is why you ought to submit to it. Don't resent it. Don't fight it with your will. Don't fight it with your emotions. For whom the Lord loves, He reproves. God always acts toward us in terms of His character, and He's always love. Now, granted, that's hard sometimes to see, is it not? The house crashes down, this isn't working out, and this is falling apart, and I don't have this yet. And that is God loving me. That's right. We cannot judge the love of God by what we see and analyze. That's doing what? Lean not to your own evaluation. That would be invalidating that. And when we do not submit to the fact that everything He does toward us is in love, we are leaning to our own judgment. And then second, notice, in the latter part of verse 12, it is even as a father, the son in whom He delights. He has a position, and His position is He is our Father. So out of His character and out of His position, we are to honor Him. Now with verse 13, we'll have something about the validity and the importance of pursuing wisdom. Notice, and wisdom would simply be, look what we've had so far. This is wise stuff. Total trust in the Lord. Honor Him with your possessions. Submit to His training program. Now, verse 13 down through verse 26 is going to say, you ought to pursue this stuff. And you can read it and see how blessed, verse 13, is the man who finds wisdom. And that simply means the decent sense to put this stuff into practice. He who finds wisdom is blessed. The man who gains understanding, for its profit is better than the profit of silver, and its gain more than fine gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire compares with her. Long life is in her right hand. In her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are pleasant ways. All her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her, and happy are all those who hold her fast. The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. It's interesting. Even in God's creation, intelligence and understanding and wisdom was important. The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding he established the heavens. By his knowledge the deeps were broken up and the skies drip with dew. My son, let them not depart from your sight. Keep sound wisdom and discretion, so they will be life to your soul and adornment to your neck. And notice how he exalts wisdom all through this section. And then we come down to how to have favor with man. And we will spend our last 10 minutes here on favor with man. We've had favor with God, and now favor with man. And that is in verses 27 through 35. And we want to do a little character study here. Notice in verse 27, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor. All right, under favor with man, we want to spend our last 10 minutes looking at friendship in Proverbs. This will become intensely practical. Friendship in Proverbs. As we said in our first session this morning, when you come to verse 27 and you see the little word, or verse 28 rather, it says, do not say to your neighbor. The Hebrew word, re'ah, is a word that means neighbor, and it also means friend. So when we see the word neighbor, we're talking about the word friend. And what we want to come from is how to recognize one and how to be one. So the lessons we'll be learning in these last few minutes will be how to recognize a friend and how to be one. What are the characteristics of a genuine friend and how can we be one? And this will come all the way down to the most intensely practical teaching I know anywhere in the Word of God. Number one, a friend has a peaceful disposition. We're doing a character sketch now. A friend has a peaceful disposition. This is looking at their personality characteristic. They have a peaceful disposition, and for that concept, turn please to Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 29. And we'll have two subpoints under the peaceful disposition. Number one is under the peaceful disposition, he's the kind of person that does not start strife. And if it ever happens to rise, he does not spread strife. He doesn't start it, and he certainly doesn't spread it. First of all, he does not start it. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 29. It says, do not, and some of these are coming off the negative and tells you how to be a good friend by saying what you shouldn't do. Do not devise harm against your friend while he lives in security before you. What's he saying? One of the qualities of friendship is you don't start strife. And if you have a friend that is secure with you, don't stir something up. That's one of the qualities of friendship. And if something does come up, you don't start it. Look at chapter 25, verses 8 and 9. 25, 8 and 9. And in chapter 25, verse 8, do not go out hastily to argue your case. Otherwise, what will you do in the end when your friend puts you to shame? And the idea involves that there is some strife risen, and you're all in a big hurry to go out and to argue your own case. And he's emphasizing that a true friend does not do that. A true friend does not spread strife. Or our first point, a friend has a peaceful disposition. Second, and this one is so wise, a real friend knows that silence is better than criticism. A true friend knows that silence is better than criticism. That's one reason why I like my cats. My cats never criticize me for anything. Okay, chapter 11 and verse 12. How wise this is. Chapter 11 and verse 12. Chapter 11 and verse 12 says, he who despises, the idea is that of criticism. He who despises or criticizes his friend lack sense. But what would a real friend do? A man of understanding keeps silent. Get the concept? A true friend recognizes that silence is very often better than criticism. You say, well, I see something that they need help with. You know what the wisdom is behind this? If you keep silent, you know what might happen? They'll probably come around for it. And therefore, this is the idea that this friend does not come along and say, look, I'm going to set you down and exhort you because I'm a fellow believer and I'm going to set you straight and tell you what you really need, and I'm doing all of this in love. And very frankly, I don't care if you are doing it in love. I don't want to hear it. You know, and this is part of the thing involved in the book of Proverbs, is that here's this man that is very critical, and he says the man has understanding does what? He keeps quiet. Recognizes that silence is often better than criticism. What do you do when a friend begins to criticize you? What do you do? Intensify the relationship? Nope. I just say, hey, if so-and-so calls, I'm not home, right? Okay. And a real friend has that kind of understanding, that kind of insight, that silence is often best. All right? Third, whenever you fail, a real friend responds with grace, not condemnation. So our third point is a true friend responds to failure on our part. Responds to our failure with grace, not condemnation. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 21. You have two parallel lines, each one explaining the other. It says, "He who despises his friend sins, but happy he is he who is gracious to the poor." And notice the poor indicates a failure. You haven't made it. You haven't cut it. You're in the poor category. And what does a true friend do toward you? Well, the one who despises you because of your failure sins. The one, on the other hand, who responds properly is gracious to you. And what is that proverb saying? A true friend responds to our failure, poor, with grace, not with condemnation. And number four principle, and this is really vital in Proverbs, a true friend is constant. A true friend is constant. And we'll try to see this by looking at, number one, the fair weather friends as over against the real friends. First of all, let's look at some fair weather friends in Proverbs. And the fair weather friends will be seen in 14:20 and 19:4, 6, and 7. Fair weather friends will simply be those friends who like you because of what you can do for them. Chapter 14, verse 20. We'll see the value of being a constant friend by seeing how bad it is to be a fair weather friend. Chapter 14 and verse 20. The poor is hated even by his friend. In other words, if you're down in a poor position, even his friends hate him. But those who love the rich are many. What's he talking about? Fair weather friends. Friends who love you when you're prospering, and those who despise you when you are not. That is not a true friend. Then in chapter 19, verse 4, 6, and 7. Chapter 19, verses 4, 6, and 7. And keep in mind now, we're not looking at genuine friends, but surface friends, those that are not constant. Verse 4, wealth adds many friends. And you really ought to get the flavor, wealth adds, quote, friends, end quote. But a poor man is separated from his friend, fair weather friends. Chapter 14 and verse, or 19 rather, and verse 6, many will entreat the favor of a generous man, and every man is a friend to him who gives gifts. And verse 7, all the brothers of the poor man hate him, and much more do his friends go far from him. So notice on the negative side, He's talking about the friends who only are there for what you have. All right. On the other hand, look at the friend in chapter 18 and verse 14. 18:24, rather. A man of many friends comes to ruin, but there is a friend, notice the emphasis on constancy, that sticks closer than a brother. A true friend is constant. Chapter 17 and verse 17. Verse 17 says, a friend loves at all times. Emphasis on constancy. Chapter 27 and verse 10. Do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend. So notice the emphasis that a true friend is always constant. Fifth, a true friend is honest. True friend is honest. Two passages, 27:6. True friend is honest. 27 and verse 6. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. And it's simply saying the true friend is honest. 29 and verse 5. A man who flatters his friend is spreading a net for his steps. Get the emphasis? A true friend is honest. Number 6. A true friend gives wise counsel. A true friend gives wise counsel. Now, this is interesting. A true friend gives wise counsel by being two things to us. A good friend is a person who affirms us. And a good friend is a person who clashes with us. That's right. True friendship. There's an affirmation and there's also a clash of rubbing together. First of all, gives good counsel by affirming. 27 and verse 9. A good friendship reassures and also braces. And we're looking, first of all, how friendship can affirm. 27:9. Oil and perfume make the heart glad. So a man's counsel is sweet to his friend. Notice he affirms him. But notice you get a little vigor in this when you come down to chapter 27 and verse 17. Iron sharpens iron. How? By clashing. Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. How? By clashing and running together. All right? Next and last, and this one is so important, and you're going to like this, because it is so down to earth. Number 7, a true friend has respect for his friend's feelings. He is sensitive to him. He respects his feelings. Or he has tact. Now here's where we're going to get right down in the dirt and see something really beautiful now in closing. This is the part where, remember we said a little child's prayer was, Lord, make the bad people good, and please make the good people nice. In our closing few minutes now, we're going to be talking about, you're a good person, you're a great believer, you belong in Hebrews chapter 11, you ought to be there with the heroes of the faith, and you're a very good person, and you're very spiritual, but you're not very nice. And I'm going to point out three areas, or four areas, in which you're just not very nice. For example, you don't know when the joking with another person has gone far enough. That's not in the Bible. You mean Proverbs talks about a good friend knows when you've teased enough and you ought to stop? Have you ever had a very good person that just, they hit a tender spot and they didn't mean it, you say, but they weren't sensitive either. They didn't recognize that, hey, I'm on thin ground out, be careful. And they didn't have that sensitivity to your feelings. All right, first of all, chapter 25 and verse 17. A real friend does not force his friendship. Now, human wisdom would say, hey, I want you to be my friend, and I want you to know that our front door is open any time of night and day. You just come over any time you want to. You know what you're setting up? You're setting yourself up for a lost friend. That's right. You say, well, that's the old down-home country way of doing it. It's stupid. It's unbiblical. It's not the way it goes. Notice the wisdom of Proverbs chapter 25, verse 17. Let your foot rarely be in your friend's house. Boy, isn't that cold? Lest he become tired of you and hate you. I'm sure there are not many people sitting here. Have you ever had a friendship that got so close and so familiar with the other person that the friendship busted up? I'm not going to ask for hands, but you know what I'm talking about? You know, you got so close, you shared everything, you poured out your heart to the other person, and pretty soon you felt free to borrow something in the house without even asking, and you got so close, and now you don't have a friend anymore. That is the wisdom of Proverbs. A true friendship is what? Sensitive to feelings. And it has tact and recognizes that the friend has a right to their privacy and I've overdone my stay. So friendship does not outstay its welcome and it does not force a relationship. Now the one that I just love. And I'm going over time, but I've got to get this in. I can't resist it. Would you think that a person who jumps out of bed in the morning, they're happy? I had a guy in college that I roomed with. And he taught me, and I love the word, but there's one verse I don't like very well. And I don't like it because of the way this guy used it every morning. He would bounce out of bed and take the responsibility of saying, this is the day which the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And I don't like that verse. I don't like that verse at all. Because his early morning enthusiasm was thoughtless. It didn't recognize that I get up with the taste of a birdcage in my mouth and no assurance of salvation or anything else. A puddle. Yeah, I drip out of bed, you know. Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 14 has some real wisdom along that line. All right, Betty, you ready? He who blesses his friend with a loud voice early in the morning, it will be reckoned a curse to him. That's getting down to earth, isn't it? But isn't that saying something serious? He gets up in the morning and he is happy and feels good, but you know what he doesn't have? He didn't have any tact. He doesn't recognize the feelings of somebody else. And a true friend is sensitive to feelings. All right? Have you ever had, one of my kind of little pet peeves, and I hope I'm not being too subjective this morning, is for someone that I do not know and does not know me to look me in the face and say, have a good day. And I want to say, you have no idea how my day has been going. You don't know me. And as a matter of fact, I'm not in a really very good mood, and I don't want to smile right now, and don't give me a happy face on my paper. Okay. Chapter 25, verse 20. No, did I miss it? I did, didn't I? Oh, no, I didn't. Okay, 25, 20. Like one who takes off a garment on a cold day. This is like jumping out of the shower when it's below freezing outside. Can you feel that? Or vinegar on soda. The mixture here was something that would be effervescent, would just boil up. Vinegar on soda is he who sings songs to a troubled heart. And what's this saying? Someone is coming along with the little surface thing, why don't you cheer up? And your heart is troubled. And it's that little surface thing of saying, smile, everything will get better. And that is what? Lack of sensitivity to feelings. All right, last chapter 26, verses 18 through 20. A friend is a person who knows when a joke has gone too far. Chapter 26, verses 18 and 19. Says, verse 18, like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man who deceives his friend and says, oh, wasn't I only joking? You get the idea. He does not know when a joke does not have the sensitivity. And all of this last point we're making says a true friend has real sensitivity. And let me read in closing something that was in Reader's Digest, and I think it's very, very interesting about the spontaneity of friendship. It says this, the delight of honest friendship is that it can be resumed instantly regardless of length of time it has been in abeyance. You ever had a person who was a friend years ago and you hadn't seen them for 10 years and you met them and you had to go through all this rigmarole, did you? No. The delight of honest friendship is that it can be resumed instantly regardless of the length of the time it has been in abeyance. There are no preliminaries or formalities to observe, no protocol to be established, no modus vivendi to be set up. And that is the nature of the wisdom that we find in the book of Proverbs. Father, we're thankful today for your word and its truthfulness. We pray that in the study of it, we may gain the practical wisdom not only to be good people, but to be people who are genuinely nice as believers and can have friends and have the wisdom of your word. For we ask this in Christ's name. Amen.